The U.S. and Iran have confirmed they have signed an agreement aimed at ending the war just hours after Washington released the official 14-point text of the deal.
The agreement had originally been due to be signed during talks in Geneva tomorrow. Washington and Tehran say the memorandum of understanding was signed electronically by President Trump and Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian. A U.S. official says the document was also digitally signed on Sunday by Vice President J.D. Vance and Iran's chief negotiator Mohammad Baqir Qalabaf in a ceremony witnessed by Mr. Trump.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson says a 60-day period to negotiate a final agreement begins today. Earlier, President Trump stressed that the time frame should not be viewed as a strict deadline, but warned that military action remains an option if Tehran fails to comply with the terms.
If it doesn't get done in 60 days, that's all right. We go back to bombing. You know, I don't want to do that because it's so good. But we might have to. Because we're never going to let them have a nuclear weapon.
But the deal between the U.S. and Iran has been described by President Trump as performance-based, with Tehran benefiting only if it complies with its commitments. So what exactly is in the agreement? Well, the memorandum calls for an end to all conflicts linked to the war, including the fighting in Lebanon. Tehran has warned that any continued Israeli military operations in Lebanon would amount to a violation of the agreement and would prompt a response. But the deal also requires Iran not to develop, acquire, or possess a nuclear weapon. In return, the U.S. would begin lifting restrictions on Iran's economy, including ending its blockade within 30 days and unfreezing Iranian assets. And at the same time, the agreement commits a $300 billion U.S. dollar fund for the reconstruction and economic development of the country that Washington is not required to contribute. It also seeks to safeguard one of the world's most important shipping routes. It guarantees safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz, with transit fees waived for 2 months. Iran says it retains sovereignty over the waterway and reserves the right to begin charging vessels once that period expires. Both sides will now enter a 60-day negotiating phase aimed at reaching a final agreement, though the timeline can be extended if Washington and Tehran agree more time is needed.
Well, Jamshi Choksi is Distinguished Professor at the Indiana University Bloomington. Professor Choksi, good to see you again. I want to start by asking you about the deal itself. It seems rather one-sided at this point, you know, with a lot of concessions made to Iran. I know, you know, this is in flux, pretty dynamic, but I'm wondering what you think the U.S.'s thinking might be behind this.
I think that, that we should approach it from the viewpoint of President Trump. He will announce that what he has achieved is that Iran has promised never to develop a nuclear weapon and that this removes a major threat from the world stage. And he will point out that that is important for the entirety of the Middle East and the world. So in that sense, from President Trump's viewpoint, it would not sound lopsided. Economically, certainly, it opens many doors for Iran. And the question that remains is whether Iran will use the funds that are becoming available for good or for bad.
That is a very big question. Let's delve into that. President Trump saying the U.S. is not going to pay 10 cents. He says the Gulf states are not going to be part of it either. So this apparently is going to be totally on private investors. And I guess the question is, how lucrative is it for a private, you know, company, you know, some sort of a VC firm or something to get in there and be involved in the process of rebuilding Iran? I mean, reports suggest that $150 billion of that $300 billion has already been committed in some way.
Indeed. So the reports, as you pointed out, are that half the amount has already been committed. We do not know, however, who has committed the funds and what the strings attached to that commitment are. What we do know is that the United States is set to administer that fund and to release monies as and when Iran complies, not just with this agreement, but presumably with the broader deal that's going to be worked out over the next 60 days or longer period. So there's a lot that is unclear. And what is also very unclear is how the other Gulf states are going to react to this. The Saudi foreign minister was absolutely crystal clear today that Saudi Arabia has suffered from Iran and that it will take time to rebuild trust and assurances. So I think your important point is that indeed there may be monies committed, but will those who have committed it follow through if Iran does not comply? And we still don't know what those expectations are.
Yeah, a lot of questions unanswered. But Professor, let's assume that those capital do start flowing into Iran, you know, between sanctions relief, access to frozen assets, and this fund that we just talked about. I mean, Iran could see hundreds of billions of dollars flowing back into its economy. Just how transformative could that be for the country? And how quickly would ordinary Iranians actually feel those benefits?
Right. So we're looking at potentially, if everything works out as it's supposed to or planned to, that over maybe a period of a year to maybe even a few years, Iran receives this $300 billion. Iran also claims that there's about another $100 billion in frozen assets. The Western estimate is probably between $60 to $75 billion, most of it, at least half of it in China, from oil sales, considerable amount in India, also from oil sales. So add that in, and then also add in Iran's wanting to charge a tariff, a toll across the Persian Gulf. We see there about 7 billion barrels of oil transiting and another 80 to 85 million metric tons of liquid natural gas transiting. If Iran were to, let's say, charge a dollar on that, and split that with Oman, yes, it's a considerable amount of money. It's certainly more than Iran has had since the Islamic revolutions, because let us keep in mind that the initial U.S. sanctions began shortly after the Islamic revolution and have ramped up. Mm. So that is going to be a massive amount of money, yep. And it is not clear how it will be spent. The Iranian central bank has announced that the money will come into the central bank and the government will decide. Will the money actually flow to for economic development, for environmental reconstruction? Iran has a massive water crisis. Tehran is running out of water. Will it flow into the pockets of the average Iranian citizen in terms of better lifestyle, international travel? Unclear. Or will most of it go to the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard? Will it go to Iran's regional proxies? And will it be used for trouble?
Okay. So as it stands, I'm assuming that there's nothing mentioned about any sort of safeguards to ensure the funds go to the right place. I also want to ask you about how quickly this can be implemented. We know that Iran is basically cut off from the international banking system, doesn't have access to SWIFT. So even if restrictions are lifted, how quickly, you know, can the money flow into Iran? I mean, I imagine it's not as simple as, you know, turning on or flicking a switch.
It is not. And there are additional complications. The U.S. Congress had previously passed law that prevents the U.S. president, at least temporarily, from releasing Iran and from sanctions, and also releasing other nations from associated sanctions. So there will have to be a legal process in the U.S. Congress. It is unclear whether that will pass or not. It's also unclear, as you pointed out, how quickly Iran can be reintegrated into the international banking system, into the international trading networks. And a lot of that also is based on trust. And that trust does not exist at present.
Mm. And Professor, money for Iran, I'm sure it won't go down smoothly with American hawks, given President Trump's been years attacking the Obama administration for giving Iran access to billions of dollars with a JCPOA. Mm. How does he explain giving Tehran access to even larger economic incentives today?
And let's say that's going to be, We often see President Trump come onto stage with a little dance. So he's going to have to do that dance policy-wide to try to explain this, not just to the American people, but to the people of the world. And let us face it, as we have pointed out, this money, under ideal circumstances, can be used to greatly improve the Iranian economy, Iran's geopolitical standing, to reintegrate Iran back into the global community as a constructive player. It is not clear whether the regime in Iran right now, more hardline than ever, and certainly having a lot of grievances after what has happened, whether the regime will do so. And if the regime starts misbehaving, then one has to assume that not only will the funds stop, but also the regional countries, the people who have to transmit the funds into Iran, including private investors, are going to immediately pull back. I mean, immediately. Private funds will flow gradually as trust builds, but at the very first incident, it'll freeze.
Okay. And Professor Choksi, given the potential long runway, you know, for this agreement to be, the final agreement to be reached, and given the issues of trust that you were talking about, I'm wondering what Iran's track record is. You know, if you look back at past agreements, past deals, do they have a good track record when it comes to compliance?
When it came to the JCPOA, yes, Iran did cheat around the margins. And it tweaked and reinterpreted every word it could. But by and large, it did have a good track record. Now, that had to do simply and only with the nuclear deal. It did not have to do with Iran accelerating its meddling in the region through its proxies. So Iran, while largely complying with the JCPOA, broke all rules around the region. And so, while Iran may actually work and comply towards this agreement, there's nothing I see in the agreement that prevents Iran from rearming its proxies. In fact, the agreement seems to protect those proxies. And if those proxies were to, say, attack Israel, one can rest assured that Israel will strike back.
All right, Professor, we'll have to leave it there for now. But thank you very much for your insight, as always. Professor Jamshid Choksi, Distinguished Professor at Indiana University, Bloomington.